make statements that sound like the others.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91 to order. We have a very exciting agenda tonight. We will be diving deep into the medical marijuana program, which will help us understand how this industry works now and how we can move into the future. So we will start our testimony today. We have no committee measures to introduce tonight. So we will start our informational meeting. I will call an informational meeting. And we will start our testimony tonight with Tom Burns from the OLCC. And if Mr. Marks is here and would like to join you. He's not flying solo tonight. Welcome to the committee.
Madam co-chairs, I'm Tom Burns. I'm director of marijuana programs for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. This committee has a title called Measure 91. But in order to understand Measure 91, I think it's important for you to understand that there is another different medical business operating in this state outside of the recreational program. I'm not saying that's good. I'm not saying that's bad. I just think it's important as you build your recreational side that you understand the other side of the business. So I put a few slides together here to try and explain the difference. Actually, it's one slide, but in order to keep me focused on what I want to talk about, I'm going to see if I can make high tech work for me. So on the medical side, you have a grower and a patient, and the patient picks a grower and says, you are my grower, I want you to grow for me, and you can grow six plants for me. And in exchange for growing six plants, you can give me all the marijuana that I need, or some of the marijuana I need, or perhaps none of the marijuana I need. That's between the patient and the grower. And legally, the marijuana that is produced by the grower is owned by the patient. So if the grower wants to do something else with the product, he or she should be getting permission from the patient to do that. So once a grower and patient relationship is established, the product, when it's harvested, can be sent directly to the patient. And the patient uses the product as they see fit. Or if the patient gives permission, the grower can send the product to a dispensary. And there could be a compensation for cost between those two, and the dispensary could then use the product to sell to other patients. The grower could also send the product to a processor. These are the people who make extracts, who make edibles or medibles on the medical side, and that process is there. And then the processor can send the product back to the patient or send it on to a dispensary. The important thing to remember about this is this area of this business is not regulated. The producer and grower relationships are not regulated. The dispensary is regulated by OHA. And the dispensary, what goes on inside the dispensary is covered by OHA. How much product the patient can get is governed by law. But what the grower and the processor do with the excess product is not governed by law. It's left entirely between the patient and the grower, or the grower and the dispensary or processor. So that's the medical side. On the, it turned color. I don't know why it turned color. On the Measure 91 side, again, we start with the grower. The grower will be licensed by statute by OLCC. The grower will sell the product to somebody. At that moment when the product is sold, there is a tax imposed. That's where the tax is collected. So the grower can sell the product directly to the retail outlet or to a processor. And again, the processor is the one that makes extracts. The processor could be a kitchen, whomever the grower decides to sell the product to. And like the transaction straight to the retail outlet, that's a taxable event. The processor then sends the product to the retail outlet, and the retail outlet sells the product to the consumer or the patient. And on the Measure 91 side, the entire supply chain is governed. and it will be licensed by OLCC, and OLCC will have various components in place to make sure that the product that is produced on the commercial side, on the recreational side, stays within the box that we're trying to create as we build this new economic system within the state. That's really all I have to say on the this point. I think that you need to understand that there are two different systems, and without that basic understanding, building the recreational side will be difficult. And so I don't know whether you have authority to go beyond just the Measure 91, but you do have to be aware of it. I told you before about the grow sites and the number of growers out there. There is that you have received a great document from the Oregon Health Authority, which identifies what is going on in the CARD program side. It is a well-written document and has a number of charts and graphs in it, and I would encourage you to look at that. I'm aware that there is somebody in the audience from OHA if you want to ask specific instructions about the seek information about the CARD side of this of the medical program. But regardless of what you do, as you build a system, you need to understand that you have two different models functioning out there, and you'll have to resolve whether that's what you want to do or not. I'll be happy to answer any questions and let you get on to the other 10 witnesses you have today.
One of the reasons, obviously, we're focusing on this is I think it's everyone's assumption that many of the growers who are really quite good at what they do, the medical growers, will want to participate in the recreational market. Is that your understanding as
that's,
well?
Madam Chair, that is my understanding as well. And in order for them to do that, they will have to either give up growing as a medical grower or and be licensed as a grower on OLCC, or remain a medical grower and get an OLCC license. The only way you can sell your product into the recreational side is if you have a license from OLCC.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Burns?
Thank Chair, you. I do have a question.
Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Burns, it's at least supposed that there's quite a bit of leakage from the medical system into the recreational system currently. And I was wondering if you have formulated any estimate or opinion about how much leakage. Can you quantify that for me?
Sure. Co-chairs and Senator Farrelly, it's tough to answer that question. With more than 30,000 growers in the state, it's very hard to tell where that product is going. I will use one example. I think I used it before, and that is an example that I was aware of during this harvest season, where we had one grow site stacked 104 patient cards on that grow site, which if you multiply that times the six plants per patient, is about 630 plants. If you assume a 5 pound per plant harvest, which for an outside grow is not an unreasonable harvest, that's close to 3,000 pounds of product. All that product came on the market at the same time. And I will tell you that my experience in the medical side is that product did not change the price of the product in the medical system. So when you dump 3,000 pounds into the medical supply chain, the price at the retail didn't change. So did it get into the system and the system could absorb 3,000 pounds? I don't know. Or did the product leave to some other location? I don't know. I think there are law enforcement who could answer that better than I can.
Follow up,
please.
So as we go forward, since you've come from the medical side, you're now going to the recreational side, having immediately come from the medical side with probably the most experience of any state agency person, do you have any recommendations on a tracking system in the medical side that would prevent leakage?
Co-chairs and Senator Farrelly, I would suggest you look at the Cole memo. The Cole memo talks about, can a state who is building a medical program or a recreational program control leakage from within the system? And I think we can clearly do it on the recreational side, but if there remains a medical side that does not have seed-to-sale reporting, I'm hard-pressed to be able to look the federal government in the eye and say, I can guarantee you that there is no leakage in the system. I don't know that there is leakage, but I couldn't say for a fact that there wasn't.
But you are, did you want to follow up
with me? Madam Chair, I just have trouble. It's a credibility issue. I cannot believe somebody that was around that system can't definitively tell me whether or not there's leakage from that system.
Co-chairs and Senator Farrell, the problem is because the only governance I had was at the dispensary level, I don't know. All I can see is what the dispensary brings in. And I can see the dispensary brought in 10 pounds and sold 10 pounds. That was the only visual I could see. Whether their dispensary was offered 100 pounds and only took 10, and the person who offered the 100 pounds went someplace else, I don't know. All I could see, because of the way the medical program was governed, was what was going on inside the dispensary.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Tom, this seed-to-sell is one model that could be used, but there is potentially some other type of model that could be used so long as there's some type of accountability as to what's coming in or going out is what we should be concerned with. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. Co-chairs and Senator Brzezinski, you're absolutely right. The seed-to-sale model is the model that the two other states with legalization are doing, as well as a number of the medical states are putting together a seed-to-sale system. We could work together and come up with something that would do otherwise. But the seed-to-sale system is what I'm trying to build for the recreational side, and building a second system creates some issues.
Right. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Stand by in case we need to haul you back here. Our next panel will be patient advocates for medical marijuana cardholders.
We can.
We have Anthony Taylor, Jeremy Kletke, Cheryl Smith, who are all here. And we also have Laird Funk, who is from Williams, as I understand it, and was hoping to be here but is not going to be able to be here, and is sending written testimony. And Representative Wilson knows him and might want to say a couple words about him.
Yes, thank you, Chair Burdick. Yes, I have known Laird Funk for many years and worked with him in my previous career here between 1998 and 2003 on this very issue. So just wanted to acknowledge Laird's time and grade, so to speak, and thank him for his testimony.
Thank you. Okay, we're missing somebody.
Yeah.
Oh, Mr. Kletke, I think, has been a little bit delayed, but he'll be in soon, I assume. So why don't we start with you, Mr. Taylor?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Co-chairs Burdick and Leniger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Taylor. I'm a resident of Yamhill County, and I'm co-founder of Compassionate Oregon, a political action committee dedicated to protecting the rights of Oregon's medical marijuana patients, their families, and the communities that serve them. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify here today and present for this committee a brief overview of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. Not sure how we can condense 16 years of history and policy into 10 minutes, but we're going to give it a shot. Even before Measure 91 was approved by voters, many of us began searching for the answer to the question we knew would be asked. Now that marijuana is legal, why do we need a medical marijuana program? We hope the information we provide the committee today, even in its brevity, will provide some insight into that answer. The OMMP is a completely self-funded program relying on no taxpayer dollars to support the program or its staff of nearly 30 people. To date, it has generated over $10 million in current biennium, resulting in a revenue surplus of over $7 million and providing approximately $9 million in additional funding for six other OHA programs. 44% of all OMMP patients are low-income Oregonians who benefit from the current patient-grower model and obtain high-quality medications for little or no cost. The needs of these patients are distinctly different than those of recreational users. The amounts allowed for cultivation and possession are greater than those established in Measure 91, as many patients require access to larger quantities to produce cannabis-infused products such as edibles and topicals to facilitate the sustained levels of titration needed to adequately mitigate their symptoms. Strains high in CBD with decreased THC and concomitant psychoactive properties will likely be unavailable in retail stores because recreational users will have no desire for them. The OMP also allows patients under 21 to obtain and use medical marijuana for medical conditions and with oversight and control by a parent or guardian for pediatric patients as well. Merging the two programs would leave that population unprotected, a population that includes children with conditions such as Dravet syndrome, a condition of uncontrolled seizures, which is only manageable with cannabis, and those with pediatric cancers who are undergoing chemotherapy and need it for nausea, vomiting, and pain. Congress recently passed the Hinchey Amendment as part of the budget bill defunding DOJ enforcement efforts in those states with medical marijuana programs, effectively making medical marijuana legal under federal law. Adult use under Measure 91 still remains in question and is merely tolerated under the Justice Department's Cole memo as a matter of policy. Merging the two programs could adversely affect this protection. As my final point before moving to our slides, I would point out that the OMMP is absolutely vital to our veterans. In the 2013 session, this body added PTSD to the list of qualifying conditions. Veterans who use medical marijuana concurrently with a VA health care plan to manage PTSD or chronic pain are only allowed to do so if they are part of a state-sanctioned medical marijuana program. While the Department of Veterans Administration is a federal agency, its policy regarding the concurrent use of marijuana with other treatment plans has been moving in the right direction, and we would encourage the Oregon healthcare community to look to this policy when they finally begin to integrate cannabis into day-to-day healthcare for many Oregonians. This time I'd like to switch to our PowerPoint presentation. This presentation provides the current statistics for the OMMP and a flowchart of how it actually works.
Before you do that, Mr. Taylor, I'm not seeing this testimony on OLIS. Would you be able to provide what you just...
Absolutely.
Thank you.
My apologies. The first slide is the current statistics as of January 2015. 70,000 patients, 47,000 caregivers, 38,000 growers, 33,000 patients that list growers other than themselves, and 1,600 physicians with a current OMMP patient. There's also the breakdown by age of cardholders and indicates that the age group 51 to 60 is the highest number of registered patients. The next is the qualifying conditions, severe pain, spasms, nausea, cancer. These numbers reflect the conditions a card is issued for. Some patients list more than one condition. For instance, there are nearly 65,000 cards issued to patients claiming severe pain, but only 39,000 of those patients list severe pain as their sole condition. This slide is part of the report that the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program staff prepared, indicating revenue received and allocated to the other programs. This is a fee breakdown for those who have paid the registration fee. 56% of all patients pay the $200 registration fee, while the remaining 44% qualify for discounted cards by being eligible for SNAP, OHAP, SSI, and veterans disability benefits. The last part of this slide is the six programs under OHA that the fees help with their budget. This last slide, as far as statistics go, is the grow site addresses with cards. As you can see, about 34,500 people or addresses grow for four patients or less, 2,000 in the range of 5 to 20 patients, and then 17 with 21 patients or more. It also indicates that just over 7,300 people patients have no grow site listed. This slide is a picture of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Card patient identification card. Similar cards are also issued for primary caregivers and designated growers for those that have never seen one. The final slide is a flow chart of how the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act works, and of course it was adopted by voters in 1998, and the authority was vested in the Oregon Health Authority, and it oversees both the medical marijuana program and the dispensary program. The patients, as you can see, are highlighted because, as Mr. Burns mentioned, they are the owners of the marijuana and at any time can ask their growers to provide them with any or all of the marijuana that they've produced for them. You can see that the small line from patient to grower under the program I made it so small because patients can reimburse growers, but seldom do. Mostly the growers provide product for patients at no cost. And then the dotted green lines is how it goes. It goes, patients, of course, authorize growers and caregivers, and product goes from the caregiver to the patient or to the grower. I'm sorry, grower to caregiver to patient or caregiver to patient. And then, of course, the medical marijuana program, the dispensary program, is a little more complicated, but pretty much similar in that, again, the patients control the authorization and the grower-caregiver relationship remains pretty much the same. The dispensaries are able to reimburse the growers for the normal cost of doing business, although the patients are only allowed to reimburse the grower for dirt and utilities. So we would encourage the committee to stay mission-focused on the task of implementing Measure 91. As everyone is beginning to see, this is a very nuanced issue and touches nearly every aspect of government policy. Oregonians voted for a ballot measure that expressly stated the OMMP would not be affected. We would also urge the committee and the body as a whole to neither forget nor compromise the needs of those patients who will continue to use the medical marijuana program long after session ends and retail sales to adults is the norm. We urge the body to take the opportunity to strengthen the program, making it easier in the long run to integrate the needs of the medical community into the primary Oregon healthcare system rather than keeping it at arm's length on the outside looking in. It is up to the legislature to ensure that no Oregonians are left without access to safe products, whether medical or recreational, and ultimately the legislature must ensure that all Oregonians have continued protection from prosecution when the final federal response to the question of states allowing marijuana use is finally written. In the final analysis, we see no reason these two programs cannot coexist. In time, Oregon may wish to reconsider this choice, but for now, we should err on the side of patients and the will of the voters. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take our next testimony, and then we'll open it for questions. Welcome.
Co-chairs Burdick and Leninger, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl K. Smith, and I'm vice chair of the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, former executive director of Compassion Center, a Eugene Medical Marijuana Clinic, and a founding member of Compassionate Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity. Anthony spoke about the need for the OMMP, and I'm going to focus a little bit on clinics, and in the interest of time, I'm going to limit my comments to just three major points. First of all, clinics are needed. Clinics evolved out of necessity, and they're now essential. Many physicians won't sign the attending physician statement. Originally, this was because they feared federal intervention, loss of prescribing privileges, loss of license, etc. That was resolved in a court case. But once the clinics started, they ultimately came to rely on those. And for an example, Willamette Cancer Center refers any patients that want to use medical marijuana to the Compassion Center in Eugene. They also, if the doctors there do sign for the patients, they refer the patients to Compassion Center to provide some other services. And that's an area where clinics have developed expertise. They not only help patients get their card, but they provide education in many areas, including dealing with the forms, answering questions about the program, assisting with dosage and safe use of medical cannabis, and other patient concerns. Some institutions prohibit their doctors from signing, and they even encourage withdrawing opiate drugs for patients who test positive for marijuana. Others, such as the VA, as Anthony mentioned, require that patients have a medical marijuana card in order to both use opiates and medical marijuana. At least one clinic provides home visits, and others offer other types of health care, such as massage and chiropractic. And some also assist patients with sharing medicine with low-income patients and provide information on dispensaries and finding a reputable grower, and in some cases, housing, health care, and crisis care referrals. I can't tell you how many people I printed out hacks of forms to find housing when I worked for Compassion Center. So these can be nonprofit social service agencies and provide a lot of services besides just signing for cards. Number two, clinics should have better oversight. They need to exist, but currently they're only minimally regulated by the OMMP, mainly through administrative rule. Doctors are required to review medical records and conduct a thorough physical exam and provider plan follow-up care under the rules. The fact is that in a minority of clinics, patients get in and out in only a few minutes, which has led to the perception that most patients are seeking only to use marijuana recreationally. We've heard the term card mills and allegations that we don't need the medical program now that we have recreational because it's just a sham. Well, that isn't true. Rather than eliminating the program, we could move this minority of patients to the recreational system simply by providing better oversight and minimal requirements for clinics, such as professional office setting, nonprofit status, auditing of record keeping and policies. And number three, we need to maintain and tap into the expertise and data that currently exist. Clinic physicians have been providing services to OMMP patients for years, and they're a valuable resource. Rather than limiting them to a certain number of patients per year, which has been proposed by a representative, we should tap into their unique knowledge as a starting point for education of healthcare professionals. In addition, we have a huge store of data in these clinics, which could be the basis for research on the effectiveness of medical uses of marijuana. I would refer you to the Compassionate Oregon's position paper for more detailed information regarding these points, and I urge you to continue the OMMP. And I believe you all have a copy of this, and if you don't, we can certainly get that to you.
Thank you. We do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Farrelly?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be interested in reading the recommendations, but as you may have heard, the committee has been admonished not to change or expand the charge of Measure 91 into an entry into the medical marijuana system. And I currently don't know what are the requirements for trained medical professionals to be in a marijuana clinic. Or are there any?
No, other than a DO or an MD have to sign the card, but there are none.
So clinics can be operated without trained medical personnel present.
That's correct.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I could continue.
Please follow up.
You make specific recommendations for oversight in the report.
Yes.
Thank you. That's going to be very valuable. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for doing that. Other questions? I see on your report and from your testimony that there are a certain population of patients that have no grow sites, 7,300 some with no grow sites. Do you expect those to gravitate into the home grow community under Measure 91? Or
Co-Chair Burdick, I imagine that those patients, up until 2 years ago, everybody that signed up for a card had to designate a grower and a grow site. They've suspended that or eliminated that requirement. And so many people that just don't have access to a grower or are unable to provide for themselves, they just use a dispensary, and I assume they'll continue to do that.
Okay, so this 7,300 is not people who necessarily grow their own. They might be people who go to the dispensary.
That's correct.
Okay.
And Co-Chair Burdick, if I can add to that, these are some of the people that are growing, patients that are growing or have a grower often will share their cannabis with those patients. And these are the kind of people that we connect at some of the clinics where they're, you know, talking about the excess amount that some people might have. Maybe a person has a real low use need, and then they can share their cannabis with another patient for no cost.
Okay.
This happens a lot.
And I know you probably have it in here, but I'm very eager to hear how you would deal with these so-called card mills that you talked about, where they issue many, many cards without much analysis of the patient.
Co-Chair Burdick, I would regulate them more. I know when I worked for Compassion Center, we, in order to not have to send so much paperwork into the state, there's a provision in the administrative rules that allows you to be audited to show that your medical records are really good, and It was a quality assurance. It's a section of OHA with a really long name that I can't remember, but something with quality insurance. And we had these people come in, and they audited our records. And so they could see that we were jumping through all the hoops. I think that would be a good start.
Okay. Thank you, because I learned fairly early on in this process that there is a small handful of doctors that account for a huge majority of the cards that are issued in order.
And
I assume that's who you're talking about.
That's because we have the clinics, and that's because the other doctors wouldn't sign. And I would contend that a lot of these doctors have really developed expertise in cannabis as a medicine, and it's a valuable resource. I would be really hesitant to limit how many patients they can sign for.
Great. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will be eventually in this committee entering into discussion of actual proposals and actual bills, and we will welcome you back again at that time.
Thank you.
So thank you for your information. Okay, our next panel is a panel of medical marijuana growers. And that will consist of William Simpson, Christopher Mallett, Amy Margolis, and Jonathan Menton. So if we could get another chair up there, we can have all four of you come up at once.
You might want to check the chair on the corner. Check the one that he's in.
Okay. They got it.
And we knew with great minds we would solve this problem. Okay. Who wants to start? William, why don't you
need to take a microphone and put it close to you, but don't. It doesn't have to be that close.
The microphone is very sensitive, so you don't need to get super close to it.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you. I am William Simpson. I'm the owner-president of Chalice Farms, also a member of the Oregon Growers PAC. Appreciate your time today. I had the honor of having a group of you through our grow facility a few weeks ago. I'd like to invite the rest of you who haven't seen it, when and if possible, to come and look at our facility. What I'd like to talk about today is kind of a walkthrough of how we have set up our facility. It is, in our opinion, set up to the standards that the state would like to see in a very tracked, very secure method. When you walk up to the facilities, very much like the dispensary program, we have high-level security all the way up throughout. We have specialized door locks that have codes, so we're able to basically assign a code to anyone that's going to enter that facility, so we know who has entered, when they were there. When they go into the facility, it goes further into the operation as far as what room they entered, how long they were there. It's all under 24-hour video surveillance. I can actually give the state a login, which I would be happy to do, and you guys can log in and look at any room in the facility at any time of day, which I think is really important for the issues with diversion. But it also allows to just make sure that everything done in our grow facility is to compliance, that we're not doing anything we're not supposed to be doing. And it allows certain accesses for certain people, like for the product piece of it and the packaging, certain individuals in the grow space shouldn't necessarily be allowed to access that medicine, as that part is all of it is tracked, but that part is going to be tracked leaving the facility and going into what would be a recreational dispensary or a medical dispensary. We have on the tracking side of things, it also implemented a very high level BioTrack technologies. We already do the seed to sale tracking, even though we're not supposed or not needed to yet. We believe that it's extremely important to do that, and going forward, I believe we're going to all have to do this. We track that every single one of our plants has a social security number, basically. So it gets scanned into our computer as soon as it has a root. That plant, it knows its date of birth, it knows what strain it is, it knows its potential yield date, it knows its potential yield, and it also knows its potential essential oil, at least from the last however long we've been testing that plant, we have the averages. Every time it moves a phase in our facility, not only is it under video surveillance, but it gets scanned into the next stage. We have what is considered a perpetual model, so that each room in our facility is designated for the different type of plant. So we have a clone and early vegetative stage room, because they're treated a little bit differently in that stage of life. They then move into a middle stage, we call it vegetatives two. They move into a late vegetative stage plant before going into flower. It's a perpetual model to allow availability of medicine consistently for the patient, as opposed to a lot of the old methodologies that would have a large amount available all at once and then not again for 3 or 4 months. And if you have a patient, I own a dispensary, so I get to see this a lot firsthand. When that patient finds a medicine that does work for them, you have to have that available consistently, and it needs to be at a high level. The other reasons we've implemented the systems that we have in our facilities, every single bit of air into our facility is all controlled through HEPA air filtration. All the air conditioning is split unit, so it's completely environmentally sealed. So we don't have bugs, mildew, mold, pesticides, anything coming from outside. Everything that we do, we control on the inside of the facility. And also, any air coming in or out of the facility is not only HEPA filtered, but then charcoal filtered to be a good neighbor and a good member of community, not allowing a very odoriferous plant. Some people love it, but some people don't. So we want to make sure that that isn't going to be a hindrance to our neighbors. But our BioTrack takes that plant all the way through to the end, and then we weigh that plant whole. A lot of the way we harvest the plant is different, I think, than some. Some people do this. But we do it as a protocol where we take it whole, because we can actually have a wet weight as a plant. And then as it's drying, you can see if somebody were to take a part of the plant off, it would spike in a loss of weight very fast. We're able to see that dry all the way to the dry weight, take that, and then that Social Security number stays with that plant as it's broken down into stalks, fan leaves, trim, and then flower. And then we are able to track as each one of those different pieces move out of our facility to the dispensary or edible producer or concentrates maker, and then from there to the dispensary. And we are able to do that right now. We do that with our product. And because we believe very much so that diversion in this system will hinder the success of it, we need to make sure that it is all accounted for so that we have a successful system moving forward, that we don't have any of the issues that I think, you know, certain other places have had. I, for one, you know, Chalice Farms, we're very excited about the possibility of licensure and going into a regulatory system like we are right now with the dispensary. It's a phenomenal system to work with. We invite audits. We want people to come in and see what we're doing, making sure we're doing it the right way. Talking about a patient, we want to make sure that this medicine is extremely safe and secure, and you're getting what you're told you're getting. You need to have an environment where you can have full control over every part of it. It can't be, you know, beer brewed in a bathtub, kind of as an analogy. It needs to be taken extremely seriously. So we have protocols in our facilities that, I mean, they're bleach mopped and bacterial sterilized once a week. This is something we go through all the way up to the walls. We use special paints that are anti-mildew, anti-mold, that don't allow for the bacteria or fungi to grow in these environments. And it's just, again, we take it very seriously because it should be taken that way. And our facilities are built that way right now and ready for that system. So we're extremely excited to move forward in this system and hope that it's a success as successful as we see it being.
Great. Why don't we take you next, Jonathan?
Just yell really loud. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Sun Grown Growers Guild. Appreciate the opportunity to be back with you today and have a conversation. I thought maybe the best use of time today would be for me to just maybe share with the committee some of the updates that with some of the tours that have taken place in Williams, and maybe talk a little bit about just the outdoor and rural dynamics with outdoor growers, how things are a little changed, different with than indoor grow operations. Talk about a few things about that have worked well, a few that maybe within the existing medical program aren't making perfect sense for a lot of our growers, and then moving forward. Williams is such an idyllic setting. It's such a beautiful place. I had such a nice time there. And it's you have you know, outdoor farms that are also mixed with herbal farms and vineyards that are in that place. Again, want to extend the invitation down for others to go visit. I've been there on four different occasions to speak to the group of a newly formed organization, the Sun Grown Growers Guild. And each time I've been there, the room has been packed full of people. A lot of times it's new people coming in, people wanting to learn what does this, when we first started, it was before the election happened. And so we were talking about, you know, what does this ballot measure, what is it going to do? What is the state legislature? You know, how is what the state legislature do different than a state agency? How is this all going to impact us as far as, you know, who are these people? What is this going to do? A lot of folks that just had not had any experience with state government and with politics in general. So I think that kind of, you know, casts the you know, a stroke of just kind of paying it, like we're bringing folks in slowly to get educated about what all this means. And there's a lot of misinformation out there, a lot that I hope we can all work together on to get folks educated so that we are doing things the right way. And there's a group of responsible leaders that are doing things the right way. The leadership is emerging, and it's very, very encouraging. You know, one of the highlights, I think, of the speaking engagements was when Representative Wilson made it very clear that he wants to hear their ideas and hear from people on the ground, and that was so well received. It's been so well received when people have been able to go down there and visit themselves. I hope that this committee will ultimately get to go have a hearing in Wilson to meet folks directly, because engaging them in that way, I think, is a very positive thing. One story, another highlight, we heard from one of the growers who is making a concentrate, and I think I had some pictures, but that's okay. You can maybe see them if you want. But it's a concentrate that is just, it's a organic oil. There's not using any solvents in the metals that were, I think, discussed at our previous hearing. And they've had incredible results. The grower almost started crying during that conversation that many of you may remember, as he was talking about the effect that this oil is having on a patient. A patient went from having 200-300 seizures a day to down to 1 to 2 a day. That's how it's delivered. So if you can kind of see, it's not a syringe. There's no needle. You actually take the, it's like you're recommended to take like a dot, like the size of half of a pin, and you would put it on your tongue or put it onto, you know, food. And then the packaging that it's in is childproof, and it would take, you're advised it would take about 4 hours for it to start taking effect. But I wanted to just kind of show you so you actually see. Sometimes the visuals help, I think, to see what it is. But anyway, just a very it's heartwarming when you hear that story and you watch somebody get emotionally disturbed and impressed by the impact that they're having on someone's life. The medicine works. Rural versus outdoor dynamics. It's in the outdoor, you know, it's a summer growing season, so you're farming. So you'd plant in the spring, and then you'd harvest in the early summer, late fall. So with that kind of condensed period, as compared to an indoor operation where you can kind of be harvesting and have more control over how much you're harvesting at regularly intervals. If it's just one growing season at the end of the summer, you would be harvesting your entire year's amount of product and marijuana at that one time. So that creates issues of what are you going to do with all that? You need to be able to store it and transport probably more of it than you currently can now. There's not that many dispensaries around in rural Oregon and that far south, so it's a little easier when we're in the cities to just be able to go back and forth to a dispensary to sell the product. When you're in a far area, just like you may have a patient in Portland and a grower in Williams, and so she may have to drive that medicine all the way up, you know, a long ways. So just the logistics of being in rural Oregon versus being in the city are kind of different. There's one farm that we visited where the woman who owns the farm, her house is kind of, I think it's a several acre parcel, house on one section where there's electricity, of course, and kind of a farm and a growing of vegetables and other you know, herbs and such, and then the medical grow was on the other side of the property, lined with cottonwood trees. You couldn't see it. It was a secure place, but that side of the property doesn't have electricity, and you're growing under the sun. So to put in a very expensive security system, when she had first heard that this was something that's been discussed, she contacted PGE to find out what she'd have to do just to bring electricity to that side of the farm, and it was a $15,000 estimate on her part just to bring electricity to that side of the farm. She didn't. That was something that scared her to death, terrified her. She didn't have the money to do that. So it's just a difference between, you know, outdoor and indoor with that guard. Maybe one size doesn't fit all with kind of the regulatory regime that we're going to put in place for the two different types and areas. Things that have worked well, this grower-patient relationship. You know, not all marijuana is the same. Not every strain is the same. Not every patient responds the same to the different strains. So what's worked well is oftentimes you've had one patient working with one grower over time, and this plant worked good this season, this plant didn't work so good this season. They mixed this, you know, strains together and come up with something, and that time it really worked. And now they've got something that's working really, really well. And so they're worried that if that was to change, that they would lose that direct relationship and ability to work with their grower and the patient. And we've got serious problems with patients that are having relief and it's working, and they don't want to see that changed. Tom had a slide up earlier that mentioned that there's no regulation of the kind of under the medical program of the grower dispensary, or I guess it was the grower site and the dispensary. But I guess it depends on what you mean by regulation. Like, you do have to get a card, and that card that you register with the Oregon Health Authority does allow law enforcement the ability to go see that site. So when you're registered as a grow site currently under the Oregon Health Authority, you have that address on the card that law enforcement has access to. And some of the two farms that we visited had been visited by law enforcement. I think that's entirely appropriate. But if you were to move that into just Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the concern would be then that you don't have the privacy protections that exist under the health authority now. And so I opened like a public record search to someone's private farm in, you know, southern Oregon where it's lined by trees, and you don't have the security operation with it. They're just worried that opening that kind of data up to the public may be a security concern. So under the OHA with it, it's kind of more of that privacy is in place, and so folks feel much more safer being regulated by OHA than they do OLCC. I'll try to go a little faster. Some of the issues that they're struggling with, and this is not an exhaustive list. Again, this is a new organization, so we have new people coming in. They're surveying other responsible growers to find out what the problems are. But some that have come up already would be the size limits, like a pound and a half between the three different entities right now. If you've got a grower, a caregiver, and a patient, you don't know how much the patient has at any particular time. So if you're the grower, you may have more than a pound and a half in your possession in the aggregate between the three, and you could find yourself in violation of the law without intending to. Again, the transportation issues and the storage issues. As I understand it, seeds are currently not necessarily legal under the current program, and that's something that we hope he would address. It just kind of makes common sense that if you're allowed to have the plants and such, that you would need to be able to not get in trouble for having seeds. And just the overall kind of like mentality of folks, I think, is that as we impose new restrictions on them, we want to be careful because the concern would be of pushing more people onto the black market by overreacting with overregulation and overtaxation. Again, we're still collecting information on what would make sense, and we'll put together policy papers as we can do that, and we'll keep working with you, hopefully. Moving forward, just stressing that conversations are happening, responsible leaders are emerging. We're working hard to build trust around the shared values that we've all expressed in the previous hearings. Patient safety, fair and accurate, fair regulations, accurate testing, a tracking system that makes sense and is user-friendly, and reasonable limits that protect the small family farmer. We have a niche, amazing niche product. I grew up in Georgia where we have Vidalia onions, and everyone's so proud if they can get their onion to be classified as a Vidalia onion. We have the potential to do something like that with Oregon outdoor marijuana, where it's, as we move into a system whereby it's recreationally legal. Like, it's something that folks are doing the right thing and really want the state to be proud of. Outside the building, messages are very important to building this trust and bringing people into the system. If we had a hearing in Southern Oregon, I think that would be wonderful. I really hope we can pull that off. We have to, as all of us, lobbyists, legislators, I think we have a responsibility all to try to imprint upon people that this process is legitimate, that people want to have their voices be heard and take part in a system that's not out to get them. And then, you know, there's been enough drama, I think, between the different groups, and you know, we need to find ways to reduce our different drama. And so I would just close by saying that as we dig into the weeds, we may have to concentrate. But if we stick you to the high road and remember that we are buds, I'm sure we can hash things out and pass this test. Shake.
I got some forewarning. He was going to make some jokes, and there were a lot of puns involved.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. You used up your entire quota of puns for the entire session.
Yeah, intentionally.
Okay. Shall we go to Christopher Mallet now? Mallet? Is it Mallet?
It's Mallet. Yeah, Mallet is an old French term. Madam Co-Chair, Senators, Representatives, thank you for having me here today. My name is Chris Mallet. I am a member of the Oregon Growers Political Action Committee. Over the last 13 years, I've served in various capacities in the high-tech industry. Most recently, I served as the Director of Technology for a company called Computer Stores Northwest Incorporated. They're the owners of the Mac Store retail chain, Power Max e-commerce business, and a manufacturing company. I was responsible for overseeing the IT group and their professional services group, in addition to being one of the principal engineers behind the technology that operates that business today and will continue to operate that business for many years to come. In addition to my past work for companies here in Oregon, I'm also a successful entrepreneur. For the last 9 years, I've owned and operated a small business here in Oregon. We market software to the financial industry that is a seasonal business. We have a little over 3,000 customers throughout the United States. I'm very proud of what we've built with that. I'm also the father of two young boys, husband to a wonderful wife. A little over a year ago, I began growing medical cannabis for my wife. She has what's called juvenile idiopathic arthritis. This is a disease that she contracted when she was 12 years old. She's been afflicted with GIA, which used to be called juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, for 25 years. She's 37 years old now. As you can imagine, over that time, it has levied significant damage on all of her joints throughout her entire body. There is really nothing from a musculoskeletal perspective that hasn't been impacted in one way, shape, or form from this disease. That has ultimately led to long use of pharmaceutical drugs like prednisone and Neurontin for peripheral neuropathy, opiates for pain management. Out of desperation and frustration for the sort of typical approach, we decided that we would start experimenting with cannabis as a potential route to treat her disease. That proved to be very successful. As it stands today, she is able to manage 100% of her pain management requirements with cannabis with very limited cognitive impact. It took time to identify strains that worked for that, but if you have spent time researching you know, various peer-reviewed articles on subject matter, you'll find that there is clearly, and as is evidenced by the volume of states that have passed medical legislation, very true medical benefits, and my wife is a wonderful example of that. I'm a steadfast believer in the medicinal benefits of cannabis, clearly. I'm encouraged in my review of the ongoing research that is taking place in cannabis. I think that research is an exceptionally important factor of where we're headed. I think that is how you ultimately prove the science behind what we're working on. And the science is fact, and fact is what matters. You know, having said that, I'm also a firm supporter, and I voted in favor of Measure 91. And with my experience as a successful entrepreneur, and my time as a medical cannabis grower, and my deep-rooted knowledge of technology, I've recently founded a business that is focused currently on the production of cannabis, technology and automation, which is clearly something in our wheelhouse, and processing, and we expect to expand that over time as we develop into the industry. We hope that we will be measured by our ability to operate as a steward of this industry to ensure that the appropriate levels of professionalism are applied and that we hold ourselves to consistent and excellent principles and protocols. Much like Williams said, regulation isn't a bad thing. Regulation is a good thing. It's how it keeps things safe. With that in mind, you know, many but not all current medical dispensaries appear interested in procuring licenses for the recreational market. To me, this is both reasonable and unsurprising. If a given facility was forced to separate its medical cannabis from its recreational cannabis, in any context, whether it's as a store, you know, separating storefront, so on and so forth, you may actually limit the availability of cannabis to true medical patients. And most of the reasons for that are true business drivers. For instance, you know, if I was given, and this is true, I think, of most entrepreneurs, if you were told you can either have a medical facility or a recreational facility, most people would look at recreational as the solution because that's where the profitability lies with respect to the consumer base. The medicinal market is a much smaller consumer base. So ultimately what that would mean is that as a business owner, you would be looking at your marketing through the context of recreational consumers. You would be looking at your sales through the context of recreational consumers. You would be looking at the varietals that you stock. As you may or may not know, certain strains that have higher cannabidiol volumes are oftentimes more beneficial because they are not psychoactive, and many patients seek that. So, you know, if you look at it through that funnel, it could potentially hinder the availability of medical cannabis to patients that really need it. And it's important not to disincentivize, in my opinion, the necessity to satisfy the requirements of those patients. The second, I would like to address producers and their ability to grow cannabis for the medical market. Currently, medical cannabis growers produce cannabis exclusively for patients who are operating within the confines of the law, and the growers should be operating and are operating within the confines of Oregon law. So that means that, as it stands today, 100% of the cannabis that's legally produced is produced for patients that really need it. However, you know, when we contrast that to the potential for a recreational market, we need to understand that many of the growers that grow today for the medicinal side are doing that out of compassion and interest in helping their patients. So the idea that, at least in my opinion, that all of the, you know, compassion and empathy that medical growers have towards patients would just somehow go away if the recreational market came online, that's something I can't, you know, line up with. I think that as the recreational side of the business comes online, you know, myself and many others will maintain our interest in satisfying the needs of patients, however we can do that. As it stands today, many patients are in low-income brackets. Many patients are not able to or may be hard-pressed to afford, as a result of taxation, those types of things, access to reliable cannabis. So it is a responsibility of the committee to figure out how we can ensure that as we enter into the recreational market, that we give recreational producers the ability to sell to both recreational consumers and medicinal consumers. It's an environment that makes sense, in my opinion. It would be difficult to quantify that as a business owner in many other ways. And the reality is that the dispensary model, in my opinion, is the future of where this is headed. And it continues to be demonstrated in the current medical environment. So, a few points there. Obviously, you know, cannabis is often used as medicine. Regulation testing ensures safety for all consumers, especially those who are treating medical issues. You can also consider that in the context of producers on the recreational side. Insofar as I understand and have heard, the regulations that are going to be imposed on medical cannabis producers will eclipse that of the current the recreational producers will eclipse that of the current medical producers. To me, that translates into increased safety. If you're being audited on a consistent basis and the state has access to your facilities and come in and look at your operation, ultimately that translates into a safer environment for the medicine that's being produced for the patients. Often a grower growing with just cards will focus on what helps their patient, but by allowing a grower to grow without patients, a grower is free to explore what strains and products would help the biggest population sample. And a good example of that is with my wife. A lot of her treatment, she doesn't smoke cannabis. She doesn't like to smoke cannabis. She doesn't do that at all. She consumes medibles. She rubs salves on her hands. If she has particularly bad days with her arthritis, she'll rub salves and she'll find relief from that. I feel very strongly about growing for patients. However, the card stacking system's artificial limits on size, plant count, and weight possession impact my ability to grow and how I want to run a patient-centered business in the most effective and efficient way possible. And then finally, as a patient-centered grower, I do not believe that licensing growers or giving them the opportunity to produce for both markets without compelled card stacking hurts patients. I believe that it helps patients for all the reasons I've mentioned above. I also believe that the cannabis cultivation community will continue to help low-income patients gain access to medicine that they need, not because they are being forced to grow with patient cards, but because we are good people who ultimately want to do good things for the vulnerable population that needs cannabis. That concludes my statements, and I appreciate your time today. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you. We'll wait till the final panelist is testified.
Good.
We'll let you bring this home, Amy.
Thank you, co-chairs and member of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I represent the Oregon Growers Pack, but I'm also an attorney.
And
I
give
practice
your name, Amy.
Amy Margolis. I'm a little out of practice. I haven't been testifying since 2008. I also represent cannabis businesses as they move forward in this industry. I thought about what would be the most helpful. I know that the committee is hearing from many patients and growers, and I participate in this process from a different perspective. And so I wanted to talk about, from a business lawyer's perspective, the medical program and how we've been operating under the medical program for the last 16, 17, 20 years. In 1998, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program went online. In 2005, it expanded to the limits that we see now. In 2013, we passed House Bill 3460. You all passed House Bill 3460. And in 2014, Senate Bill 1531 created the moratoriums that we see in effect in many counties and cities. When the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program was created, and we say this to our clients all the time, it was created as an affirmative defense to prosecution and a safe harbor provision. It was never created to be a commercial statute. So we often will have clients come in and say, I'm starting my cannabis business. How do I put this square peg into this round hole? So let's talk about where we are now, because I know the committee is tasked with implementation of 91 and running the marginally regulated medical program alongside of that has a direct impact on the implementation process. I know that the committee has heard and understands what the medical program looks like. There are growers. You can grow for four patients. You can have six plants per patient. There are certain 24 ounces of usable marijuana per patient, and you can have as many growers at one grow site as you want to have. That's how we wind up with collectives and co-ops that you see across the state, both indoor, outdoor, and in greenhouses. You have patients who are in the unique space where they own all of the medicine produced by their growers. We can talk about the actual tax implications for a patient who owns all of a product distributed to a dispensary at a later date, but it's something as this emerging market grows that lawyers are thinking about. So patients have the ability to designate their growers and a caregiver. They also have the ability to release their product to a dispensary. Caregivers, when we give this explanation, are a pure possession card, meaning that, and when you hear the phrase card stacking, either in a nice way or a not so nice way, oftentimes we're talking about caregivers. So when I say a pure possession card, that means that I can possess, as a caregiver for a patient, 24 ounces of usable marijuana on behalf of each of my patients. And I can have as many patients as I want to caregive for. The fourth leg of that stool, stools have three legs, but in this case, the fourth leg of that stool has really become the 3460 licensed dispensaries. Now, that is created from a business lawyer perspective, a very unique, I'm calling it unique, unique position for the medical program. So remember, when you're hearing testimony about the medical program, there is, you hear from patients and you hear from growers, but there is this commercial market that exists as a result of legislation in the medical marijuana system. So I thought of, as I was going through, putting aside the grower-patient relationship, which has many positive things. People can take care of their patient. Low-income patients can get medicine for free. There are a lot of benefits to that system. But I don't want to talk about that because you've heard so much from other people. What I want to talk about is how the people who are growing and processing and creating products for the medical system, which will either exist in a streamlined fashion with the recreational system or as some sort of separate operating commercial market, how, what the struggles are and what the positives are for that market. And I'll try and do it rapidly. Usually it takes me an hour. So the things that are a challenge, and we'll talk about for growers, under the medical system, the commercial medical system, again, I'm going to avoid the patient-grower relationship because you've already heard about it. For the medical system, if William is growing for a dispensary, he has to find patients, and he has to manage. His main goal is to grow for dispensaries, because we've created a dispensary commercial market. And I saw that number up there, and I thought it was very interesting. There are 219 licensed dispensaries in the state of Oregon. The statistic you saw up there was that 7,000 patients don't have growers. But it makes good business sense to know that 7,000 patients are not keeping 219 dispensaries open and running. So we know that just because people may have a grower, they are still accessing dispensaries, commercial medical dispensaries, for their medicine. So we should make sure, and I'm hoping that the committee will think, as you're going through this process, not just of the grower-patient relationship when you're thinking about medical marijuana, but that you're actually thinking about the expanded commercial market that has been created, the legal expanded commercial market that has been created. So growers have some struggles, and I thought it was really positive to hear Jonathan speaking on behalf of the Sungrown Guild about some of their struggles, because I think it is indicative of some of the changes that maybe everyone on this panel wants and needs to see in the medical program. There are issues with plant size. So right now you can have 6 mature plants and 18 immature plants per patient. 18 immature plants, immature plant is defined as 12 by 12. So that means that growers are artificially having to cut back their immature plants just to stay in compliance so they won't be arrested or subject to some sort of prosecution. You have weight limits that are really disassociated with the actual amount of cannabis that can be produced, particularly in outdoor regions. So you have people, growers in particularly, constantly juggling their plant numbers, their patient numbers, just to try and stay in compliance for their production for a valid medical commercial market. So it does pose a challenge for a business owner, a cannabis, medical cannabis business owner, moving forward. Let's talk about processors for a moment. I know you haven't heard too much about processing. This exists, members of the committee, in kind of a nether world. You saw some images of processed material, and you heard one of our members of the PAC talk about salves, which are often made from concentrates, not necessarily consumed either by smoking or eating, but are often what you make salves with to help truly sick people. Processors exist from a business lawyer perspective in the most difficult place of anybody, because you need a lot of material. Processors were never really considered when this was drafted, right? So there's not a history of that. So again, it's a square peg in a round hole. So processors are doing one of two things. You need a lot of material to make very little product. And the product is very strong and concentrated. It's called concentrates. So what we have to tell clients, and what I think this committee is tasked with, is fixing some of these issues, is you are going to need to stack your caregiver cards. So that means if I want to run a business making salves for my sick wife or my sick husband or my friend who I am a caregiver for, I need to have enough caregiver cards in order to run my business, producing for a valid commercial medical market. And when you need, if you have 100 pounds of cannabis, you need a lot of caregiver cards just to make a very small amount of processed material. So this is another one of the challenges that the commercial market has created for the existing card program. It is very difficult. The final thing I would like to say about these particular challenges is that for now, and you heard Compassionate Oregon talk, right now we have a reimbursement model. And so my law partners are former Schwabe lawyers, which is a nice big firm, and they help traditional businesses. And I'm channeling my partner now, but it is very challenging when you have somebody coming in and they say, I'm selling, I believe in this as a medical product. I am creating a product and I'm distributing it to patients through medical dispensaries. And they say, and we say to them, you can't take distributions. You can't take dividends. You can only be reimbursed. You can have a business, but you can't actually make any money in this business helping sick patients. So this is, no other industry exists like this. So this committee has an opportunity to make some of these changes, whether you touch medical in other ways or not, whether you touch the patient-grower relationship, whether you merge these together, you have an opportunity to help those who are producing for patients and producing for the medical program to build something real and some sort of business that functions on the same plane as every other business in the state of Oregon. I guess I'd like to thank the committee for letting me testify. Again, usually this presentation takes me a lot longer, but I appreciate the opportunity, and I tried not to use any puns. Next
Jonathan
time.
Jonathan used everybody's pun. Yeah. Are there questions from the committee?
Chair Burke, I think one.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Question to Mr. Simpson. One thing that you didn't mention, or if you did, I missed it. What do you do with the vegetative waste that's just unusable at the end of the day?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, we take it and mulch it. We also use it in creation of salve. It just depends on the quality of those fan leaves. A lot of them into late flowering stage, as you're flushing a plant, it basically cannibalizes into itself and pulls all the additional nutrients out of the material, and sometimes it'll turn into basically a completely necrotic, dead, dry, brown leaf, not usable. There is no more, well, we don't believe it is. I mean, there may be some use down the road. We just mulch it up and we use it back into either our soil if we use an enzyme to clean it down or put it out into yard waste.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to ask you, from your description of your business, you are a card stacker. You're what people call a card stacker. Yet you seem to be determined to have a regulated business that can be audited. Do you have any thoughts on steps that we can take in terms of at what level do you think regulations should kick in terms of numbers of cards, anything like that? Any thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I would love to replace those cards with a single license mm-hmm. from the state that says I can produce cannabis at X level. I don't know what that level is. It's whether it's square feet or amount of plants, and be able to distribute that product into the medical and recreational here coming soon market.
Can I do one follow? And Chris, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this too. I think one thing I'm struggling with, and I've met many people in your field who I believe are tremendously sincere, but how do we guarantee that patients will have access to medical marijuana, given the fact that, as Chris mentioned, the dollars will be in the recreational side, the profit is in the recreational side. I hear what you're saying. There are great people involved, and people are motivated to stay with patients, but what can we do to guarantee that there will be medical marijuana for patients in need in our state?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I don't know that I know that answer. I know for our business, we want to use the potential large revenues in the recreational cannabis side to help supplement the medical side. At least that's our business model. Because the medical community is such a small market share compared to what the potential recreational side would be, I believe we can help make that medicine even more attainable to that medical community. And as far as the business goes, at our dispensary, we do donate free medicine to patients now.
I tend to agree for the most part. I mean, there is, it's a complicated question that you're asking that, short of, guaranteeing that the medicinal side will continue to exist in whatever form it takes, and that there's a mandated requirement for producers to produce specifically for medical patients. I think a lot of the the opportunities for that to happen will happen through normal business processes. For example, my wife and I would very much like to start a foundation through our companies, which are Fire Gardens, to help folks acquire cannabis as we move forward, regardless of the requirements, rules, regulations, obviously in compliance with those requirements, but as a potential venue to help ensure that happens. And I've talked to many growers who feel similarly. As William says, he would be interested in looking to supplement his, you know, recreational, you know, portions of the medicinal side from his recreational business. So I think that however things turn out, you know, we can't answer your question, but I think that that will happen if the right people are involved in this industry.
Can I just to sum it up, again, I appreciate the responses. I think one thing that I think people wrestle with is the cards right now guarantee that there will be marijuana in the system.
Well, I don't think you need to take the cards away necessarily. I mean, it, you know, you can I don't know exactly how things are going to flesh out, but, you know, that's, you know, you don't have to say that there can no longer be card-carrying medical patients.
No, I'm sort of referring to growers, the relationship between the cards and growers.
Well, one venue potentially, again, I don't know for sure, but one venue could be that the growers can also produce medical cannabis and can also produce medical cannabis for medical patients. So if a grower could operate as both a recreational producer and a medical producer, that might be an avenue to, you know.
Thank you for your indulgence.
No, I appreciate it, because this is a question that's on my mind as well. How do you make sure you have a stable supply? And one of the things that occurred to me that if it is an actual requirement, perhaps, that recreational producers produce a certain amount for medical use. And how would that go by for those of you who are contemplating entering the recreational market?
Well, Madam Chair, maybe I'll just add a little bit. From what I've heard, it sounds like there's not anticipation from the individuals I've spoken to that there would be a shortage of medical produced. Mm-hmm. I think that there probably will, and we don't really know, I guess, you know. But from the people that are, you know, seem to be make guesses. That's not what I'm hearing. I don't think that they think there would be a shortage of medical produced. And if someone's growing good medicine that's working for somebody, we don't want to limit that. I think we would want to make sure that medicine is available to more people. And how we go about doing that is all stuff we're kind of still talking about. I think you hit on a good issue. I think the folks that are growing really good medicine tend to believe that there'll be enough. If we set it up right, you can grow enough medicine to take care of the patients that need it.
And did you want to add something?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. I personally would be happy with a license that said you have to grow X amount for the medical market. That's okay. That's our intention. Taking into consideration the different sizes those markets are, I don't know many people in our situation that would disagree with that.
So if there's a shortage, it goes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Madam Chair.
Hey, thank you. So I really appreciate everyone coming and talking to us from all the panels today. There was one comment that really resonated with me that I think we need to bear in mind as we're moving forward. My impression is that the really wonderful operation that Chalice Farms is, which I had the pleasure to see, you know, it has a lot of very sophisticated equipment, and it's indoors and has some really magnificent systems. But I think that the idea that one size fits all does not fit all is kind of compelling. When I think about the sites that I visited in Williams, which are outdoor sites, where people may not have really sophisticated fencing, might be pretty reluctant to engage in self-apply surveillance mechanisms so that people could, you know, look in on their house, which happens to be right next to their farm at any time. And, you know, for whom startup costs like that might be prohibitive, and who we're trying to invite to come into a regulated system from a somewhat less regulated context, as we heard earlier. I worry that we need to strike a balance so that we don't create barriers to entry for people who may be in the medical system, who may want to come into who may want to get more involved with the Measure 91 adult use recreational system, but we don't want to intimidate people or create prohibitive costs or just alienate people so much that folks don't choose to become part of the regulated market. They step further back out of a regulated market, because that's the whole goal of Measure 91, was to kind of encourage people who might be skeptical of a regulated market to get more comfortable with it. So as someone from Southern Oregon and someone who kind of appreciates the cultural differences that I think there are between some parts of rural Oregon and Southern Oregon and some of the wonderful people who are growing perhaps in the more northern part of our state right now, I think we've got to really attend to that as we craft a system that's going to work going forward.
Question.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Leininger, I wanted to respond to that, and I would urge the committee, I mean, we have a number as part of the PAC, a number of Southern Oregon growers who have contributed to the conversation, and a major processor who's located down there as well. And I would guess that the Sun Grown Guild and the PAC are aligned in saying that we hope that the committee uses common sense and reason in making rules and regulations, which I think everybody expects will happen, that will bring people into the legal market, which will prevent diversion, which will make sense given the differences between indoor and outdoor and greenhouse growing, which nobody has talked about. And so I think our anticipation, I can't speak for the Sun Grown Guild, and I'm certainly not as funny, but I anticipate that the committee will be able to use their common sense and reason, will take a practical approach in terms of how cannabis is actually cultivated in each geographical region represented by the members of the committee, and make rules and regulations that fit each of those regions. And I think I'm speaking for both of us that we're hopeful the committee will take that on.
Do you want to add anything to that?
Oh, no, I just appreciate the comments.
Common sense and reason from the legislature. That's going to be a good time.
Senator Ferrioli, would you like to ask a question?
I have several questions, Madam Chair. Thank you. It's pretty clear that we're currently producing far more cannabis and products that can be allocated without surplus to the current markets. It's just really clear to me from listening to the commentary. Are you, and this is a suggestion and a question, would you be prepared to help with suggestions from your experience base that will help us prevent leakage from the current medical system? Because I guarantee you, if we do that on our own, you will not like the product that we produced. I think I have a consensus of those who've seen the product of our work over the past several years. So would you be prepared to bring recommendations on how the committee would be instructed by the industry how to prevent leakage rather than us, you know, getting creative, which, as I said, I don't think you'll like. That's a question. And you don't have to answer right now. I'm asking if you would be prepared to bring those suggestions to the committee.
And Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I think I'll let everybody answer this time themselves. I know that we've made that offer pre-session, and we will continue to make that offer. We have a number of suggestions, I think, that Co-Chair Leininger said it very well, which is that the goal of this is to bring people into the system, and the easiest way to stop leakage is to bring people into the system. We have a number of suggestions, and every one of us, I think, is happy to help you.
And, Chair, I'd like to see the submissions to the committee for the record. We need to have recommendations. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please follow up.
Many of us have gotten phone calls in our offices in the last 12 or so hours, some of them of a threatening nature. Not death threats yet, but those I expect later, admonishing us not to enter into any form of regulatory interface with the medical system. You know, leave it alone. But what I hear you saying is that you would invite the committee into the medical system to make certain improvements and changes, you know, not only to protect the supply for medical users, but to guarantee that there will be a reliable product, a certified product, available when needed in reasonable quantities at reasonable cost. None of that stuff is in Measure 91. So, you know, against the admonition from citizens not to engage in any sort of regulation in the medical system or interface. It sounds like you're asking us to enter that area. Yeah. I want to confirm that.
Sungrom,
there are some changes that we'd like to see in the medical program. I don't know yet, but I think the answer, best answer to your question is yes. I'm not. Doesn't matter to us which committee makes the changes. We want some changes though to improve it certainly. And I think like as we talked about earlier this week in the labs conversation especially too, where that's not in Measure 91, but we support certifying labs. So,
Madam Chair, I just would really suggest that the growers and the laboratories and the dispensaries come forward with a set of recommendations if they want us to enter into any regulatory changes in the medical side. So that it's quite apparent to proponents of 91 and others that there was agreement for a need for change and that was requested of the legislature. And then finally, Madam Chair, this is a question we've discussed quietly. Over years, cannabis THC contents have gone very high as growers have learned their craft. And I wondered whether that was through genetic modification or happenstance. How does it happen? Is marijuana a genetically modified crop?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, not in our gardens. Basically, what I believe is Mother Nature or God gave the plant a genetic potential. With science and education, we've been able to get it closer to that genetic potential. No two plants are alike, no two strains are alike, and they all have that genetic potential. Just like within each strain of plant, you have different phenotypes. Like each seed is its own plant. It's like children, no two are alike. One could be an athlete, one might not be able to jump more than 2 inches high. Every single plant has a potential, and we have just gotten a knowledge level to a level that we can get a lot closer to the genetic potential of the plant. But it's still just reaching what Mother Nature intended it to be.
Madam Chair, it sounds like a diligence, selective breeding, careful records keeping, making the right selections for cross-pollination.
Right.
I think you're describing genetic modification, but maybe I am. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, we'll carry this fight to another day. Are there other questions for the committee?
Just to follow up on that, as a farmer, I know what genetic modification is, trust me, and that's it, and that's not a bad thing.
I mean,
that's reality. We don't want to get that confused with the whole GMO thing. Okay. That's
a different some labeling issues.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I'd like to follow up on that comment real quick. I also, just a second, what Senator Cruz said, it is an important part of this process. Breeding effectuates, particularly on the medicinal side, the net results that we're looking for.
Yep.
Great example of that are, for many years you had breeders focusing on high THC strains, and so you've seen an increase in the ratios of THC to CBD and some of the other chemical structures within these plants. That same research or that same effort is now being put into strains that are CBD rich, very much propelled by what has taken place in Colorado by the Realm of Caring Foundation and some of the other folks that have been treating children with intractable epilepsy because those are the medicines that work most for them. One of my patients is also my cousin who has been suffering from epilepsy for 18 years, and she's nearly able to manage her condition exclusively with cannabis. She still takes some pharmaceuticals, but these substances, the chemical structures, are very novel, and so the genetic modification, whether that occurs through science-based process where somebody is actually splicing DNA and modifying genes, or it happens through traditional means of farming and agriculture, is an important part of the industry.
Yep. And it's not a bad thing, okay?
Kozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This kind of brings us back to what I wanted to follow up on what the co-chair have said. My concern right now is to ensure that the medical program stays intact for the transition of what needs to occur. What I'm hearing is that many growers are going to be looking for the profit side as a business, and they're going to be looking at what they can do to maximize that. We do know that in many places, and I understand Colorado's starting to see this turnaround, but at the same time, the THC, higher the level, the more popular it is, the more you're going to be producing that. So one of the concerns is that as you see that transition occurring, if it goes too far, those who are basically able to do the CBDs are going to be on the outs from the dispensaries because of what the dispensaries may be wanting to be bringing into their stores, because that's what the market is wanting. But at the same time, we know that patients, and I have a grower friend who's got a ratio of 40-1 on CBD.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing what's happening. So to me, the niche, ensuring that individuals who are now in the program have the ability to maintain their medicine, and through maybe 4 years from now, we'll see some other transitions that occur. But this is so, you know, with a program that's been intact for 15 years in the state, to walk away and say that we're somehow going to collapse it into this other item that we have not even seen and know how it's going to actually work, I think puts a lot of Oregonians at risk.
Yep. Well, it worked with the Oregon Health Plan. Here, Oregon worked just fine. There's no problem
with
that.
Just an observation. When I ask people what they mean by preserving the medical program, what I often get is just exactly what you said, the continued access to the right kind of product, the continued relationship with the grower, mm-hmm. who they trust.
Yep.
And that's going to be challenging for the committee to get a system that makes sense, one with the other. But I think we can do that, and I agree with Senator Farioli that we need the constructive participation of you all, because those objectives are what's important. And it's important that we get there in a way that protects some pretty vulnerable Oregonians. Are there other questions? Thank you so much.
We'll be hearing more
from all of you. Okay, our final panel is our law enforcement panel, Lieutenant Kevin Walruff and Patrick Ashmore.
Madam Chair.
Welcome
and
to
committee.
Me.
I am Lieutenant Kevin Walruff with the Medford Police Department. I am currently assigned as the commander to the Medford Area Drug and Gang Team, and I've been asked to discuss some of the issues that we have in our area in regards to card stacking at the grower level. We'll say as the PowerPoint's coming together, part of our job is to protect the rights of those who are growing under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, and also hold those accountable that are working outside of that. And some of these examples you will see here are those that were held example, and some of those that were acting within it as well.
Great. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about your department in the Medford, how long you've been there, and what kind of activities you do.
Madam Chair, I have 24 years of experience. I came to Medford in 1992 from the Curry County Sheriff's Office and the Joe County Sheriff's Office prior to that. I've been a patrol officer. I've been a detective. I've worked in supervision since 2006 as a patrol sergeant as well as a detective sergeant with the Financial Investigation Unit with Medford. And in 2010, when MADGE was developed as a HIDTA task force, I came over to help put that together and start investigating those for the Jackson County area.
Great.
And as of 1 year ago, I was promoted to the position of lieutenant and was offered the opportunity to run the command of MADGE.
Thank you for being here. You traveled quite a ways to get here. as Representative Buckley can tell you, and Representative Wilson.
Big deal.
We've covered, this is the area, the jurisdiction that we cover, Jackson County, and the population that we have. And this has already been discussed, the outlines for OMMP and the card holders, and the measurements and limitations that card holders can have. One thing that the state does not cover is how much a grow site, how many growers can be on one grow site.
All right. That we can do. Yes, we can do.
This is the current numbers as of February 2015 for the numbers for Jackson County in regards to patients and growers. And then over to the right, we have the numbers, which I thought were interesting, for outside of the state card holders. Mm-hmm. And 569 card holders of growers. You have to grow inside the state of Oregon, but you don't have to be an Oregon resident to be that grower. But you do have to grow inside the state of Oregon. This was what I found on Craigslist just the other day. This is a grower that is looking for patients to actually grow for in the Southern Oregon area. This one here in particular was from Josephine County. Patients can find growers through clinics, through places that sell hydroponics or grow equipment, and through other patients. This was a case that we had initially investigated. We have to triage some of our cases down there when the complaints come in. This is one that initially had come in 2010. What we would commonly do is go out to grow sites, ask for permission to do a compliance check on a grow site. A grower does not have to let us onto the property. And it is considered HIPAA protected. So if we go to these and we knock on the door, we explain who we are, what may possible complaints we've received on the location, and we will do a compliance check on that and then document the compliance or out of compliance. When we contact the OMMP program, we give who we are, what our badge number is, and then they can tell us that property contains so many patients and so many growers' cards. What it doesn't tell us is who those patients are and who those growers are. We have to provide those names for them with name and date of birth, and they can either confirm or deny that that person is on there. Mm-hmm. This one ultimately wound up as a federal investigation and had 456 plants on it. It was for 76 patients and 19 growers. This was one of the plants on there, and this was after the top had been taken off the plant. The investigators that did this did process one of these plants and process in excess of 10 pounds of marijuana product in bud. This is another picture of that. Ultimately, the individual in this case was federally prosecuted for delivery of these drugs to outside the area and outside of the state. Those individuals had come here specifically to grow marijuana underneath the OMMP program. This was another grow site that we had visited, and again, it complied. This one complied with the OMMP program. Actually helped the grower organize his cards to put the cards with the plants and make sure he had the right paperwork in order. Ultimately, this grow site wound up being tied into the one from Gregory Road that you had just seen in the sales and was ultimately taken down in the federal investigation.
What happened to the folks who were convicted in that investigation?
Madam Chairman, the only one that was convicted was the main business owner of that, and he received 15 years.
Okay. And we're running a little short on time, so if we can move through this, that'd be great.
I will go through this quickly. This is another grow that we had. Again, a number of cards. This one was not necessarily growing and distributing outside the area, but we did ultimately find over 300 plants that did not have card holders to it. This is just another
stacking grow site that was legal. And this is another. These individuals in this did have ties to people that were distributing outside of the state. And this one here was another grow site out in the Applegate area that was taken down in a federal investigation for his distributing outside of the state under OMMP. And this is just a graph, and we've already gone through that, how much the plant can actually produce, to what goes to the parent, the patient, and then the overage of that and what would happen with that overage. It's for the money that can be made outside the state, it's desirable for some. This is one that I had just heard about. This is in Josephine County. This I actually got from a federal agency that flew this, and these are individuals who are from outside the state and have OMMP verified that there are 111 cards at this location, and it belongs to a dispensary owner in California, and that is where it is suspected to go back to.
So is that legal to send it to a dispensary in California?
It is not to leave the state, no. We work several cases. We on a weekly basis, get information from other areas, states east of us, and it has almost become a running joke that in some states, if you have an Oregon plate, it's almost probable cause for a stop. Thank you.
Let me ask you this before we move to our next testifier, even though I'm breaking my own rules here. Do you have any sense of the marijuana that's getting out of state and into other states? And do you have any sense of how much of that is from the medical marijuana system and how much is from flat-out illegal, unprotected grows?
Madam Chair, I do not have those numbers. I do believe that it's a high percentage because they can grow those plants there under the cover of OMMP and not be under scrutiny at that point. But I do not have those numbers. But I do believe a large majority of it is.
Oh, yes. Could we get those overheads as part of our record?
They are. They're on.
Are they on there? I just missed them. Thank you very much. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chairs, Representatives, Senators of the Committee, thank you very much for having us here today. My name is Patrick Ashmore. I am the Deputy Superintendent of the State Police, have been for 2 months and 11 days now, so here I am. I just want to briefly go over, for the sake of time, some numbers. I do have some information I'd like to provide to the committee that would highlight some cases and some details regarding investigations that are involving medical marijuana. Just really quickly, 2012, we had 327 marijuana cases we were involved with. We, as in OSP, we report through our DES, our Drug Enforcement Section. Out of those, 128 were associated with medical marijuana violations. In 2013, there were 272 marijuana cases. Of those, 89 were associated with medical marijuana. And in 2014, 239 marijuana cases, and of those, 64 were associated with medical marijuana. Really quickly, I just want to highlight, we have 20 cases that I'm going to provide you information. Unfortunately, I have to go back and redact a couple of those cases. There was some information we probably shouldn't get out to the public. So I will do that. I will make those cases available to you. They're interesting cases. They all have to do with the diversion of medical marijuana. All of the cases that I refer to are cases where the marijuana does go out of state. It's grown here in Oregon. It's going out of state. I have 19 cases that I'm going to give you to look at. I also have 17 parcel cases where, in that particular situation, where we all the marijuana that's going out in the parcels, it's money coming back in. All the seizures are money when it's coming back into the state. Consistently, I haven't found one that isn't that way. So with that, I will conclude. I know we're running late, and if you have any questions for me.
We want to give, I just want to leave plenty of time for questions because I know there'll be quite a few Senator Farioli.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
You get to go first this
okay,
time.
Great. Through your efforts at the state and county levels, have you determined the size of the bread box for the illegal industry in Oregon? Do you know how big this this marijuana enterprise is in our state?
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Farioli, I'll try to answer that question. We have many cases that we get tips on that we cannot follow up because we don't have the resources. So unfortunately, we really don't have any idea.
Madam Chair, just one other question, which I'm sure will be the number is a surprise, just one. We're going to undertake the crafting of some licensure procedures for people who will grow for at least the recreational portion of this industry. Would you be prepared to help us with recommendations about the depth and the level of background investigations that we should reasonably do to call it due diligence when people make application for these licenses?
Madam Co-Chairs and Senator Farioli, absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. My assumption is that when the program started, medical marijuana program started, the out-of-state, the ability for an out-of-state resident to have a card was the idea being that they couldn't access needed medicine in their state. They could access it in Oregon. Given that we are going to now have a recreational marijuana component, does it make sense, because it does to me, that we simply end that part of the medical marijuana program and reserve medical marijuana cards simply for Oregon residents and just stop giving them to out-of-state residents?
Madam Chair, Senator, or Representative Buckley, I would agree.
Thank you. And the other thing in Colorado has done well, just to note, Madam Chair, and we've talked about this, is that the residency requirement to participate in the program, the legal program in Colorado and in Washington, it's required to have lived in the state for a certain number of years. And I would look forward to discussions amongst the committee of what residency requirement we would have to be a licensed grower, a licensed facility owner. But I think it should be Oregonians in this program.
How about voting requirements? Can we do that?
Automatic registration?
You're automatically registered.
Maybe not.
Get a card.
Superfluous issues are creeping into this committee. Senator Farioli.
Senator Farioli. No, it's not.
That's fine. Yeah. The one thing that you also brought up to our attention, that some of the individuals that were caught up in these investigations were actually non-residents that were growers. So following up on what Representative Buckley said, would you also agree that if it was limited to growers that were residents of Oregon, that also might help shut down some of this pipeline instead of having people, I'm assuming, just from your location, they're coming in from California and they're growing in the state under the card as a grower?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I believe that would help.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Not just California, by the way. What's that? Not just Senator California.
Olson, you look like you have a question.
Yeah, I don't have a question, Madam Chair, but just an observation here. I mean, when William was up here, I was kind of worried that maybe he was a undercover guy or something. Just a week.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
We're getting on stereotypes here.
I'm not profiling.
Is it fair to say that if we succeed in really reining in the leakage out of the medical marijuana program, which I think a lot of people want to do, is it fair to assume that you could divert more resources to grows that are clearly that are not under the legal cover at all? Because I know a lot of those exist as well.
Madam Co-Chair, I would agree with that.
And what is your process for locating and moving in on those illegal grows?
Madam Co-Chair, there's a lot of different techniques, and Lieutenant is in the field now, but when I used to work in narcotics, either through informants, a lot of our information, a lot of cases I will highlight for you are car stops that develop into an investigation where the suspects will either begin to talk about, confess their sin, so to speak, and lead our investigators to marijuana, illegal marijuana grow sites. And the other way is the evidence that you receive or you retrieve when you do a car stop. Our troopers and detectives are trained to look for things, pocket trash, things like that, that will develop cases.
You don't want to give up all the trade secrets now.
I think you're right.
We would like to invite you to participate in the process because we want something that really works, and we do understand on this committee and in this legislature that the challenges for law enforcement, especially in the southern and some of the rural parts of the state, that they're really pretty thinly stretched for enforcement, and want to make sure that the people who are doing the right thing have an easy path and the people who are doing the wrong thing have a very difficult path.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions from the committee? A quiet group tonight. Thank you very much, and thank you all the people who came to testify tonight, and we will continue on with this information gathering endeavor and until we get most of the major issues covered. And we have a hearing coming up next Wednesday, Representative Leininger.
Yes, we do. Yeah,
Monday. Yeah, Monday.
What about Monday?
Monday.
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 Yeah, Monday.
What about Monday?